front desk.
Good morning and welcome to episode 72 of the Cracking Backs podcast with your hosts, Dr. Terry Wyman and Dr. Spencer Barron. How are you doing this morning, guys?
Hey, you know what? I woke up, so I'm doing fantastic.
Hey, Lance, how are you doing this morning?
Doing great. So today we are joined by Charlie Brown. No, not that Charlie Brown. This Charlie Brown has been a full-time Glendale Fire Department fireman since 2010, where he's been ever since, and currently serves as a paramedic engineer on the ladder truck. In 2018, he helped launch Next Run, a nonprofit with a mission to end firefighter suicide. Since that day, they have helped over 500 firefighters, first responders, and spouses with free counseling and mental health treatment. How are you doing this morning, Charlie?
Great. Thanks for having me.
You know what, Charlie? Thanks for coming on the show. I know it's early and you had to get before the kiddos get going, but we've known each other a long time, and you've been a fireman for a long time. You know, you went from football player, really active. What got you into the fire department just in the beginning, just to kind of set the stage? How did you want to become a fireman?
Yeah, well, it sounds, you know, cheesy, whatever. Every kid grows up wants to, every kid, but a lot of kids, you know, grow up and they're fascinated with fire trucks or, you know, big trucks, whatever. And I was no different. But from a little kid, I just had this fascination with the fire department. And, you know, my parents always said, like, yeah, he'll be a fireman. And as I got older, you know, I really did. That fascination just stayed with me. And even in my high school years, I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I really just tried to tailor my athletic career and my education path towards a career in the fire service, wanting to play athletics at the college level. I did. Played football at Cal Lutheran, and then I found the closest thing that I could that would set me up to, knowing that the fire department was a lot of medical, in nature and paramedic stuff. So I got my degree in exercise science and sports medicine, and I felt like that would set me up pretty well in terms of anatomy, physiology, those types of things. And so that's what I did. And as soon as I graduated college, I started on my journey to become a fireman. And I was fortunate enough, I got hired with Glendale in 2010, went to paramedic school after that. I've been a paramedic now for about 10 years, and just recently promoted to engineer, which drives the fire engines and fire trucks within the last year. So yeah, it's been a good career. Never know that I'd be running a nonprofit on the side as well. So it's kind of a trip.
Sports science. The stuff that you learned back then, do you have any application to being a firefighter now or a paramedic? Do you train in the way you were educated?
Yeah. So, you know, I always thought that, or kind of like my idea was that, you know, a lot of firefighters have, you know, second jobs. They have like part-time things. They're like firefighters and they do other things. And sure enough, a lot of them were. There's the 30 years ago, you know, a lot of fire guys were coming up through like the trades, right? They were construction, plumbing, electrician, whatever. And when housing markets and things like that were going down, they were looking for steady work and they became firefighters. And then they continued to have their jobs. So like, I've always known firefighters that had two jobs in a sense. And so I had this idea that I would be a firefighter. And then because I love sports so much and coaching and just, you know, I knew I wasn't going to continue to play that at a professional level. But I thought that if I took my education and put it in something that I enjoyed, that I could then parlay that and use it on the side in the future. So whether that was coaching athletes or training, personal training or anything like that. So my emphasis that I got in was in human performance. So I did exercise science, sports medicine with an emphasis in human performance. So biomechanics type, you know, training. And the anatomy physiology part of it really set me up for being a paramedic, because when I went to paramedic school, so much of the first part of being a paramedic is just learning the human body and the systems. And for a lot of folks that have never had any sort of like anatomy physiology class or whatever, or they're going back to their biology class in high school, you know, it can be really hard. And for me, it was, you know, I just recalled all that stuff fairly simply. And now to this day, being a paramedic, you still, that application of it all, knowing how the body works, you can, you know, diagnose traumas and kind of, you know, work your way through certain medical scenarios and things like that, and figuring out what's the true root cause of what's happening here, or what's going on with someone. But now as I'm getting further into my career, you know, I'm coaching my kids now, and I'm about to coach my son's football team for the first time. My daughter's softball, soccer, things like that. So, you know, as I'm getting older and my kids are getting older, and I'm looking for opportunities now to kind of use that. I went on to coach CrossFit for a little while when my kids were a lot younger. So that was an application there. But yeah, you know, I just, something that was a passion of mine, and I thought that I would use it, and I'm trying to use it as best I can.
It works.
Oh yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I love the idea of sports medicine. I think that's fantastic. And then the application of that to the human body and taking care of it like you do. One of my best buddies in high school was a fireman for many years, but he also did personal training as mm-hmm. his second job too.
And yeah.
So I can understand that. Charlie, let me ask you a question. You know, pardon my naivety, because I'm here in South Florida and you're all the way in California out there near Los Angeles. So I know that each department is a little bit different, or maybe dramatically different in terms of activity from one to the other. Is your department active or busy?
Oh, yeah.
Busy as hell?
Yeah. You know, I think, and like I, you mentioned it, you know, kind of depending on where you're at, demographics-wise, things like that, city landscapes will determine how busy your fire departments are. But yeah, my department is 10 miles northeast of downtown Los Angeles. We're right on the outskirts. We border multiple different cities and jurisdictions. We're in between Burbank and Pasadena. We're right at the foothills of the Angeles National Forest. And so my department itself is about 30, you know, the city itself is about 32 square miles. We have 9 fire stations, and last year we ran over 20,000 emergencies, out of 9 fire stations. So, yeah, we're fairly busy. We have, you know, but like anywhere, we have some fire engines that'll run 20 calls a day, and we have some fire engines that run 2 calls a day. You know, it's just a matter of where they're located within the city. And, like I said, some of the demographics and that nature, some of them are more in residential communities that don't, you know, have, high traffic, because when people go to work, they're gone during the day. And then our fire engines and fire stations that are downtown within the city with the high rises and things like that, and lots of people, you know, they have more responses. So, yeah, we're a busy department, in, you know, kind of retrospective of other agencies.
So, yeah, you know, it's interesting, because I was asked by a fire department not too far from here to work with them in regards to exercise and nutrition and all that. I'll get into some other questions about that for you later on. But my understanding was one of the busiest departments in the country was out here in South Florida, because firefighters are required to be paramedics, and they go out on every call. Mm-hmm. Is that similar to, so is that what you guys have to do, or is that what you chose personally to also be a paramedic?
Yeah. A lot of like fire agencies, they will set what their standard of care is going to be. And for some that, like a lot of the smaller departments, the paramedic is the highest level kind of you can achieve in the fire service. The next thing would be a nurse and a doctor and so forth. You're kind of seeing that a little bit now here out in California. There's a couple departments that have nurse practitioners on staff. They're not firefighters, but they're nurse practitioners, and they kind of roll around in different types of apparatus. But so for some of the smaller agencies, like having a paramedic at the highest level of care, so they require everybody to be paramedic. We're kind of different in that we're one of the largest agencies in LA County, and yet we still require everybody to be a paramedic, and how we transport people to the hospital. So my department has we have our own ambulances, and we can transport people to the hospital, which requires that we be paramedics to be able to do that. Some fire departments that don't have ambulances to transport people, and they contract with companies such as like AMR or Gold Coast Ambulance or whoever it may be, that those are the paramedics. So then the ambulance takes the patient from wherever they're at to the hospital, and the firefighters don't have to go. They might have one paramedic on the fire engine, you know, someone that can start an assessment and kind of start that treatment, but then pass it off to the ambulance crew. Whereas we're not, my department and a lot of departments around in California in general, is that, you know, everybody's a paramedic and everyone provides, you know, a level of care at that highest level. But it really is just kind of dependent upon the cities, the municipalities, what they're capable of doing. If they're capable of providing that care, then that's what they'll do. But yeah, so we go on every call, right? As paramedics, you know, it doesn't matter what, the emergency is, you know, that jack of all trades, master of none is sort of, what we're all about. We go on every emergency. It doesn't matter what it is.
So let me ask you, because again, you know, my generation, I'm probably older than Terry. I am older than Terry. Probably. I'm just making it kind of a mystery, but no, I am. But back in the day, it was, you know, you got the fire department and then you got, you know, the paramedics. So with that said, you know, I never realized, you know, you always hear about veterans of the war and the military, you know, their issues with PTSD and trauma. You know, please share with me. I never realized that firefighters, paramedics, first responders go through similar things. Can you share that perspective, please?
Certainly. Yeah. Like when it comes to the military stuff and all that, I mean, we have a lot of veterans on the fire service. I think, you know, when they come back from military service and then they, if they're not career, they do their time and they're looking for something that's similar, you know, much of the fire and police departments, are paramilitaristic. I mean, the way that we train, the way that we do our fire academies and police academies, and even more so on the police side than the fire side, but very much based in the military way of getting things done. And so we have a lot of veterans that come in the fire service. I like to reserve that PTSD type of acronym, if you will, for those folks, because like the military, they go, let's say, like, you know, most recently, right, with all the conflicts and all that stuff, you know, they go away and they're gone for 6 months, 8 months, whatever it may be, and then they're fortunate enough to come home. And now, so they went to combat and they faced, you know, just complete utter chaos. And then they were removed from that situation and now they're back home and they're in a stable environment and they can't cope with that. Like, to me, that's, you know, when you're removed from an environment, that is PTSD. Like, you know, if someone that experiences, you know, like Route 91, you know, we had friends that were there, we were supposed to be there, all that stuff, whatever, but, you know, they were there and that, you know, gnarly incident, and then they were removed from it. And so you've experienced something, you've been removed from it, like PTSD. With us as first responders, we like to kind of look at it as like cumulative trauma. It always, like, you never get fully removed from the situation. You go, you run an emergency, and it might be utter chaos. It might not. Majority of the time, what we deal with on a daily basis is, you know, for the most part, you know, minuscule, if you will. It's not always, you know, body parts everywhere. All that. It's just not like that all the time. Now, we do see that, but it's just, you know, it's not continuous. But anyway, you know, the continuous trauma. So you go and you experience something that's traumatic and the incident is over. You come back to the fire station and the tones go off again. And then you're out the door and you're on to the next one. And you never had time to process what it was that, you know, happened. And so now you're on to the next thing, right? So let's, and it could be anything. Like I was talking about, we had kind of different levels of incidents. You could have really traumatic, bad accidents or bad incidents. Then you could have really minor ones, you know, like for us out here in California, specifically Los Angeles area, some of like the major incidents that come to mind, like we had the Chatsworth train crash, right? The Metrolink train crash, where these two trains just went head on into each other. One was a freight train, one was a passenger train, and you can imagine which one won. And there was just, you know, utter destruction and life loss and all this stuff. Well, those guys that responded to that incident, right? Like you go to a train crash with people and, you know, everywhere. And then as soon as that's over and it's like, hey, we cleared the scene and we're done, and you go back to the station, you know, and then boom, the lights go off again. And now you're going to, you know, someone who just, you know, tripped and fell down. Right. And so now you're going from this, like the most extreme event to a very minor event, and you haven't had any time to decompress or go down between those two. And you're supposed to, and you might still be thinking about, you know, certain things. And now you have to tailor, you know, our treatments wise and all this stuff to the incident that we're on. And it can be hard to focus on those things. So you finish that call, you go back to the station, and, you know, you might start to decompress. You might start some sort of process or whatever. And then another incident happens, and then you're off and you're out the door, you know? And so it's like, you never really have time to stop. And then, you know, depending on where you're at, it's not like this everywhere, but, you know, lack of sleep. So you come back to the station or whatever. And, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you sleep at the fire station, the job's easy because you get to sleep. And it's like, that's just not the case. Yes, we have beds and we sleep at the fire station, and we try and sleep as much as we can. But the reality is that people call 911 24/7, and some places more so than others. You know, we have fire stations where we'll get up, you know, four, five times, you know, six times from, we call them like calls after midnight, yeah. But let's say you go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, and then you get up six times between the time going to bed and when the morning starts, and the tones go off at 7 o'clock the next morning. And so, you know, and each time you get up, even if you get up, excuse me, and go just to the fire engine, and they say, hey, you know what, cancel, you don't have to go. Person says they don't want anybody. And you go back to bed. That's still the physiological response of getting up, going, preparing yourself to get on a fire engine to go. You're not, you know, you're not just able to go, you know, right back and reset. And in the case, sometimes you have to go run the call. Now you're awake for, you know, an hour at a time. Sometimes, like if we run a medical emergency and we have to take someone to the hospital, it's usually about 45 minutes to an hour each time. And if you have four of those through the night, I mean, that's almost 5 hours of no sleep. So these compounding continuous trauma events that you never get to decompress from, you know, we go home. So for me, I work a 48-96 schedule. So I'm on shift for 48 hours and I come home for 4 days. So let's say over the course of the 48 hours, I run, you know, 20 emergencies, you know, 10 a day. It's like an average, you know, decent time. And we get up twice every night. So we get twice on one night, twice on the next night, and then I come home for 4 days. Well, that first day, the science of what they're looking at now, like sleep deprivation, and they're studying the Navy SEALs and a lot of military, you know, folks and sleep deprivation and some of the effects of that, you know, when you wake up just once, they say that, you know, it takes, I think, like an hour or 90 minutes of REM sleep to try and recover from that one. So if you imagine I keep waking up and you're never going to get into that REM sleep for that long, you're never going to recover. And then you're going to go home. And a lot of times what we see is the first responders, they go home and they're disconnected from their family. They're disconnected from work. They kind of dissociate, you know, spousal like marriages and stuff like that. You know, there's conflict in the home because, you know, why is my firefighter so grumpy when he comes home? Why is he not happy to see his family? Why is he or she not, you know, more, you know, happy and go lucky and all this other stuff? And it's like all the stuff that we did while we were at work, we come home and we, now it's like, okay, now we're going to decompress. But by the time it takes for you to get through that, let's say 2 days, now you're home for 2 days, then you're right back into work, right? And for some work schedules, I'm fortunate we work a decent schedule. The previous schedule that I worked wasn't like that. You worked a day and then you're off a day, and then you worked a day and then you're off a day, and then you worked a day and then you're off for 4 days. And so those days in between, there, you never recover. It's like you'd come home and it would be, we call them wasted days, because you're not getting anything done. You're exhausted. You still need to catch up on sleep. Probably not getting much done with the family and things like that. And so, you know, it's just compounding. And if you do that over the course of a career, 30 years is what we're mostly shooting for, is a 30-year career. All those compounding events are just eating away at us. And if we don't have a way to shed those things, to decompress, if we don't have good, healthy habits, to take care of ourselves, taking some self-care wise, and we're just not being aware of those things, we're not, just taking care of our families or being aware of our needs per se, recognizing and trying to head something off before it turns bad. If we don't have that, then it ends in some really bad, instances, whether that's divorce, family separations, drug and alcohol abuse. And then the worst, would be a suicide. So, total respect for the military. I think I have the highest reverence for those folks and what they go through. And I have a cousin of mine is deployed right now, out in Kuwait. He's in the Air Force. And, I can't imagine, I go to work for 48 hours and I come home, and during fire season, wildland fires, I might go away for a few weeks. My cousin's been gone for almost 6 months, and it's a completely different animal. I think, what they do is absolutely incredible. And then what they've faced over the last few years being a military member, I think, they need so much. But us as first responders we need to tailor our health and well-being and look at the things that are really, really destroying us, and a lot of it can be self-induced type stuff that we're not aware of.
Hmm. We just got a brand new puppy and it wakes us up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm already grumpy. So I can't, I never even thought of that side of the sleep deprivation. I always thought it was what you saw on your job. I didn't even think about the sleep deprivation, but when that cutest little freaking dog barks at 3 o'clock in the morning, I want to kill him. So I get that. The question I have, Charlie, that our brains don't really develop until we're like 25. So what do you see when these guys are coming out 19, 20, 21, and they're being thrown into this, and they don't have not only the brain, but the physiology to handle this? Is that a factor, or is it more of just physiology? Anybody? Or is it one major incident you see that can just throw you off the edge? What's your thought on you have degrees in physiology, what's your thoughts on these men and women coming in when their brain isn't fully developed and they have to deal with this?
Yeah, to be a firefighter, you had to be 18 years old and have a pulse. I mean, that's kind of what it used to be. It's like being in the military. Now there's a little bit more requirements to it, which kind of limits how young people are getting hired, but there are certainly still folks that, are getting hired younger and younger. I was fortunate enough, I got hired at 26. I think everybody, it doesn't matter what age you are. Everyone has their own breaking point, right? It could be day one. It could be 35 years down the road. And we need to learn that you can't discriminate against, either one, right? Right. You can't look at the first one and say, a person who's brand new to the fire service, and, if you've never done CPR on somebody, and so it's not even just the fire service. They start off, most people that start off a journey into the fire service start off working as an EMT, working towards being a paramedic or whatever. So they're working on an ambulance. And so in that regard, one of the first traumatic events that they're going to see is doing CPR on somebody. And if you've never done CPR on someone, or seen it done, it can be absolutely terrifying. You start doing compressions on someone's chest and you feel their ribs breaking, underneath your hands, and you're just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to kill this person. because I mean, am I pushing too hard, or what's, you know, happening? And then all that's happening in the course of that event, you know, with respirations and family screaming and whatever it may be, you know, whatever it could be, if it's outdoors in a public area or it's at home in a private area, whatever. But that event in itself can be traumatic. And so it doesn't matter if you're, let's say we got, you know, we got some folks that later in life that they decided they wanted to, you know, change of career choice or whatever, and they're coming in and they're 40 years old, you know, and good on them, you know, like 40 years old and they're jumping in and they're going through a fire academy and they're completing it and doing lots of, hey, good for you. You know, I'm only 38. I just turned 38 yesterday, and I don't want to go through a fire academy again because I don't feel like I would make that breakdown. That's why I have you, Terry.
Yeah. So,
you know, so for them, again, even though that they've been around, you know, they're 40 years old, like that first experience is going to be, or can be, eye-opening and traumatic. And then they're like, I don't know if I want to do this. It all seems, you know, well and good until you get to have to do the job. And then it's like, is this really what we're doing? You know, so I just say we just can't discriminate against, you know, what someone's breaking point is. The big thing we need to do, and being aware, even if we're not the one experiencing the event, we've been there. If you, you know, for someone who's had experience and has been through that event, is being aware and saying, for that person who's seeing it for the very first time, like, hey, it's okay, right? Are you, is everything okay? Understanding that that could be a traumatic event or something like that, that you can, you know, you got someone to talk to, you got somewhere you can vent, you can shed anything like that. They're comfortable communicating, you know, just to make sure that they're okay. I think in the past, like the fire service in general, first responder community, it's been, you just don't talk about any of that stuff, right? Like this is the job. You would have people that would go and do that. And then they, you know, those types of emergencies, they would perform their duties. They would come back to the station and inside they're just like absolutely terrified. They don't want the, they don't want the tones to go off again. They don't want to run another call because they're still absolutely mortified about what they saw on that previous one. And they feel like I'm not going to be able to perform their duties, whatever. And they're just internalizing all this stuff, right? So building and building and building. And pack it down. We just pack it down and show no emotion. And I'm good. And don't worry about me. And, you know, suck it up, kid. It's part of the job. It's what you signed up for, blah, 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 right? That was, that's old school, you know, fire service, military, whatever, you know, suck it up and move on to the next one. And that's just not the case. Like you just can't, we can't do that. That's just, we're for one, and it's not because you're weak or because, you know, you just don't get it or whatever. I mean, physiologically, our brains are not designed. And like I said, I don't care if you're 50 years old and been doing this for 30 years or you're 18 and it's your first time. Our brains are not designed to take and process some of these things, right? We cannot physiologically, we're just not designed as human beings to take trauma continuously like that and to just, you know, process it and move on.
Charlie, I know police officers after, an incident, they get debriefed, you know, they get that moment with the psychologist or the therapist or whoever. I mean, I don't know the detail of how the, you know, how it all happens, but I'm not hearing that you guys get debriefed or you have a, you know, after a major trauma or mass, you know, injury, you haven't said anything about where you would go today. So is the system broken?
Yeah, I think, well, so we do have what we call critical incident stress debriefings. Like that is part of our, like one of the things that's come up over the years, as the fire service has evolved, as things have evolved, we have implemented tools to decompress and you know, treat our folks. Critical incident stress debriefing or critical incident stress management is one of them. And then now what we're seeing is peer support, which is what our organization Next Rung helps to provide. But fire departments are forming their own peer support teams and doing that regard. And we could talk about that. But Yeah, like what you see mostly though is that those are reserved per se for larger scale incidents, right? So like, for instance, the train crash, right? When the train crash happens, they're going to take everybody from there, and they're going to like, and it might happen, you know, a couple days down the road. It might happen right after. They're going to usually try and capture, you know, everybody that was there and do a stress debriefing. That's a big incident. It affects a lot of people. And, you know, they're going to provide, and they'll bring in a clinician, and they'll bring in, you know, their trained personnel, and create an environment, just to kind of talk about, you know, what happened. And, you know, if anybody wants to talk about it, you know, we're here to talk about it. And so it really, like, that kind of depends on what the incident commander or whoever's running the incident, if they deem it to be worthy of, you know, having that. So again, we kind of save those for like the bigger incidents. Well, we go on a ton of incidents, and they're not just like the big ones happen rarely, and we go on incidents on a daily. So it's like we should be doing that continual, but we don't bring in the whole SISM team for, you know, a cardiac arrest, because we'll run 4 cardiac arrests in a day, you know. And so it's like where we need to go in terms of like the fire service and first responders in general is creating a culture of mentality of where we are continually decompressing with each other, right? And creating an environment where we're all talking about it and we're all decompressing, and not having to say, hey, put your hand up and say, hey, I need SISM, and then bringing the SISM team in and like decompress from one thing. Like, we still need those, right? But on a daily basis, though, we just need to do a better job of decompressing from the things that we do on every day. You know, while like maybe to the general public, they might look at that, you know, like doing CPR on somebody, like that's traumatic. You might, you know, I mean, if you talk to people that you know, in terms of like a cardiac arrest type deal, and they might see that one time in their life, you know, maybe not, you know. See someone go into cardiac arrest.
What's a CPR. What is what? You referred to SISM team. SISM, or something.
Oh yeah.
Like what did
critical
you
incident refer- stress management. CISM. We just call it SISM.
Oh,
sorry.
He's in Florida, so he's a little slow.
No.
You knew what a SISM team was.
Of course I did. So, so hey Charlie, you brought up a couple points, and one of them is old school versus the new thought process. And old school was like, suck it up, you know, be a man, all that kind of stuff. And you guys are, we look at firemen, first responders as our heroes, kind of like Superman. We come to you guys to help us. And sometimes I think we put you on that pedestal that you're not human. You're our saviors. And, which isn't fair. And you brought up another thing, and you called, about this organization called Next Rung. And I got to hear more about that and how it started. And I've read some of the stuff, and we're going to post it on your site. But can you tell us about the new wave and how, instead of going, we need to do something, you guys are actually doing something. And can you explain Next Rung and what the purpose is?
Yeah. So like I mentioned before, you know, it's creating this culture of where we're talking continuously with each other. And like I said, there's a push in the fire service and first responder community to create these teams called peer support teams. And what those are just, you know, groups of individuals that go through some training. And really what we are is just, we're active listeners, you know, and when incidents happen, And it could be anything. It could be something at home. It could be something on the job. It could be whatever it may be. We're here. We're your peers, right? We stand beside you. We know what the job is all about. We run the same calls. We do all the same things. And so we have an understanding of what it is or where you're coming from. And so you have that peer, right? It's peer to peer. It's like, hey, I'm just talking to somebody that is familiar with my, you know, sort of situation, and I can just get this stuff off my chest, right? It feels so much better. I just get it off my chest. There's no, I'm not looking for any sort of, you know, magic solution or, you know, solve all my problems or whatever. But a lot of times just venting and getting stuff out make you feel so much better. So we've started these peer support teams, and Next Rung, our organization, we founded in 2018. as a nonprofit. And it's myself and Blake Stinnett, who's a buddy of mine who lives in Georgia. He's a firefighter just outside of Atlanta. And we started this idea back in 2017. Blake himself came up with the name. He had the idea of, at first was like kind of selling some t-shirts, things like that to raise money, to donate to a nonprofit. We decided, well, why give the money to another nonprofit? We can just start our own. And so, and we were looking at ways of trying to make the fire service better. Both really big into fitness, and, you know, trying to make ourselves better in that regard. We feel there's a huge connection between your physical health and your mental health. And so, you know, we're like, at the time, 2017, summer 2017, no one was really talking about mental health. It was just kind of a little red button. You know, you hear some fire chiefs talk about it and be like, hey guys, your mental health's important to us. And, you know, just let us know if you have any issues. You can always talk to the fire chief. And it's like, no one wants to talk to the fire chief. You know, it's just not like, no, I'm good. You know, because for one, there's fear, right? People don't want to talk about things because there's fear of being disciplined, you know, hey, or someone's going to think I'm weak, or, you know, it's going to get out there and they want to keep it confidential. And they don't want people seeing them in some sort of light, like they can't handle their problems, you know, like, oh, look at so-and-so, like can't even handle his own family. Like, you know, how's he going to do here? Whatever, you know, because we are at the end of the day, I mean, we're a bunch of gossipers and, you know, there's a joke. It's like tell a friend or telephone, tell a friend, tell a fireman, and it'll, you know, whatever your problem is, it's going to be out in the public, you know? So it's like, guys are like, clam up. We don't want to talk about things. And Blake had an incident where he had one of his academy instructors who he was like, dude, the guy was solid. Seemed like he had no problems whatsoever. You know, guy committed suicide like 6 months after the academy was over. And he's like, and a lot of times we see this when you hear of a first responder taking their own life. It's always like, I had no idea that guy or girl, you know, seemed like they had everything going for him. Why would they take their own life? That just, it just doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, we're really good at putting up, like putting on a show. Like we're really good as first responders at like just drawing a line and keeping, you know, work and whatever over here and just leading this, like, hey, you don't even need to know, like that, the adage, the duck, right. That's on the water and like feet underneath are just going a mile a minute and up on the water, just looks all calm, cool, collective, but no one knows what's going on underneath. Mm. And it's like, we need to get what's going on underneath because you don't know what's, you know, what's that going to lead to. And so we started that process and in 2018 we launched and we're like, how are we going to help people? Let's, you know, how can we talk to people? Social media is a big, you know, thing nowadays. And that's a way to communicate with each other. But we needed some way where people could reach out. So we started a phone line, where firefighters, first responders from across the country, they can text into us. You know, a lot of times it's hard to verbally say, like, hey, I have a problem. But text messaging, I mean, it's no problem. You just type it out all day long. And so that's been huge. And so we started off just Blake and me just answering text messages and phone calls. And we always said if we helped one person, then it would be worth it. And we would take all of our money. Like we would pay for treatment if we had to. But people have been donating ever since. We've grown our peer support team. So now it's not just Blake and me. We have 17 peer supporters from across the country. Oh. We have people in Florida. Awesome. We have people in Hawaii. We have people on the West Coast, New Mexico, Texas, South Carolina, Georgia. We're trying to expand our team, you know, and get more people online so that, you know, we have peer supporters in all different time zones and different areas and they can try to, you know, communicate with each other. And then, you know, the next step was like Blake and I, when we first started, you start text messaging people like, all right, we're going to help people, right? We're going to, let's just talk about issues they got going on. And I kid you not, like if you were to try and write out a TV script or a movie or whatever, like come up with the worst possible like scenarios, you couldn't do it. You could not come up with some of the stuff that people are dealing with. And it's just like this is above me. This is above, like, I'm sitting here as a, you know, 15 year firefighter, you know, with some experience, seen some things, done some things. And it's like, I got nothing. I don't know. That's not in my playbook. That's not in my, you know, carousel of photo images, you know? And so how do you talk about this? You know, and so the next step beyond that was getting people to like professional counseling. And so we're like, hey, we're not professionals. We're not mental health professionals. We're simply firefighters and we're just trying to help. And so, but this, you know, these individuals, they need some extra help. And so, you know, what can we do to get them there? You come to find out there's a lot of hangups, for folks that, you know, insurance doesn't cover mental health treatment. It's getting better. Still not very good. They don't want to go see a counselor because they're afraid again, that they're going to get disciplined for something. That it's going to get back to their fire chief or whatever. It's against the law, but the fear is there. You know, I don't know who to call. I don't know where to find a counselor. I don't know. I can't do that. I can't, you know, all these that prevents them from going. And we're like, you know what? If we took everything off your plate, would you go? Everything, including the finances and everything, would you go? And if people say yes, then all right, then that's what we're going to do. So Blake and I started making phone calls to counselors. Like, where are you at? You know, most of, like when people call in or text in, it's completely anonymous. We don't know where they're coming from. We don't know the fire department. We don't know any of that stuff. They can give us that information if they want, but it's not required. When they move on to, hey, we need to see a counselor, then that's when we ask, okay, well, where are you located at? What's, you know, city-wise, don't need to know your fire department. Don't need to know your fire chief. Don't need to know any of that stuff. Just where are you at? And so then we just start, you know, putting a plot on the map and start making phone calls to counselors in the area, say, hey, this is what we do. Do you deal with first responders? Some of them say, hey, I've already gone to a counselor. They had no idea what I was doing. They had no idea what it was like to be a firefighter or be a first responder. They are no help at all. You know, some places they have employee assistance programs or EAPs. And part of an EAP, they have a counselor on file. Well, guess what? That counselor happens to be like an adolescent counselor, and they don't really, I mean, they have a counselor on file, but they don't really deal with first responders per se. And so someone went through their EAP program and they're like, I got zero help from my city. I got zero help from my EAP. This is completely useless. I'm not doing it anymore, you know? And so we're like, no, we're going to find counselors that know what it is that you do, that understand the job. And so we start, you know, vetting them out, saying, hey, are they culturally competent clinicians? Do they understand, whether it's military, fire, police, whatever, maybe making sure that they understand what that is. And then we arrange the payment for them and say, hey, just show up, just go. You're taken care of. You're paid for. You got an appointment. Just go. And so, you know, we started doing that. And now we contract with the Counseling Team International, and they help us to facilitate getting people into treatment. We provide financial aid for licensed counseling up to like six sessions, you know, try to get people back to baseline. So they have their intake session and they get multiple sessions after that, and try and get them back to baseline. You know, they're good. If they need more, we can certainly help to cover that or offset those costs. And then the next one is like inpatient intensive treatment, like someone who needs to go to intensive treatment. Some folks, it's substance abuse. What do you need? You know, if you have a substance abuse problem, that's in its root causes or are in trauma and all those things, we need to get them treated. You know, we have some really great relationships with folks, and we're sending people to treatment centers for substance abuse. We're sending people to treatment centers for trauma. You know, but at the end of the day, it all takes money to do. And so as the nonprofit, everything is done with donations. We're super blessed and grateful that we've been able to provide any of the service without, you know, spending a single dime of our own money, which we said we would do if we had to save someone's life, because it's worth it. And so to date, you know, since 2018, like I said, we've helped over 500 people through our peer support line as a minimum. We did 270 peer support contacts last year alone. And we did 60 counseling sessions, or 60 first responders that went to counseling, and over, I think, 7 or 8, you know, full treatment center stays, you know. And for some treatment center stays, I mean, you're $18,000, for a treatment center stay. So, for some are less, but, you know, we were able to financially cover all those costs. So we're just super blessed and fortunate to be able to do that, to be able to impact these lives and get them back to living their best life. You know, I tell people, when it comes time to like when people are on the fence about whether or not they should reach out for help, or, you know, they may feel like they're not adequate enough to be doing this job or anything like that. You know, it's, you kind of mentioned it a little bit, like we're superheroes in people's eyes, you know, and we're super grateful when people, you know, are appreciative and, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, we're not superhuman. I don't even, you know, like we're not extraordinary people. There's nothing special about us. You know, I just try and tell people like we're normal people. We're just like, you know, we're your neighbors. We're, you know, just average folks per se, but we're placed in extraordinary situations, Charlie, on a daily basis.
Charlie, I got a quick question or a comment. Excuse me. I realized I was reading on the Next Rung website something that moved me in a manner that I just have to share with the listening audience. It says, there's a quote: "Remember, the only thing that's constant is change, which means there's never a reason to make a permanent decision for a temporary problem."
Mm-hmm.
That to me resonated with the sound of suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that was your intention, you know, or that kind of thing. You know, what are statistics like in that realm? Now, hopefully your Next Rung is going to bend those statistics into a more positive manner, but do we have, you know, an idea of, you know, that, how many firefighters or first responders?
Yeah. So certainly that is exactly what that refers to. You know, we try and tell people like, hey, no matter how bad you think things are, and they can feel really, really bad, you know, everything's temporary, and, you know, that decision is permanent, and that permanent decision, you know, it passes on. It doesn't just stay with you when, you know, if you were to choose to take your life. And so don't choose a permanent decision to a temporary situation. And so, yeah, you know, in the first responder community, we are, in terms of like against the general population, you know, times likely, you know, we're about 5 times more likely, I think, to commit suicide or die by our own hand. Back in 2015, I believe it was 2014. You know, that was like one of the first times that suicide, first responder suicide, had outpaced line of duty deaths. So like a line of duty death would be like dying in a fire or dying of a cardiac arrest, you know, or something in the fire station or, you know, police officer or something like that, dying as a result of your work duties. There was more suicides than there were line of duty deaths. And it's hard. The thing is now to track numbers because, you know, for one, people don't want to admit that they had a suicide. There's fire departments that they're, you know, people in general, that they don't want to admit that they had a suicide in their department or that someone took their own life. And so it can be difficult to try and track accurate numbers. There's a really great guy at Arizona, Jeff Dill, who runs the Firefighter Behavioral Health Alliance. And he's doing his very best to track all the numbers. He has all the most current statistics, in terms of firefighter suicides over the course of the years. But yeah, it's just, it's a rising epidemic, amongst ourselves and our peers that, we're choosing,
Charlie,
to,
we're
good.
Yeah. We're going to need to wrap up, but I wanted to have you share this Next Rung's got your six throwdown and what that means. If you could tell us real quick.
Yeah, sure. So we partnered with a guy named Chris Torres. He works for FDNY and, he runs their like FDNY barbell club. Like I mentioned, we have a serious passion for physical health and mental health and tying those two things together. We think that they're absolutely congruent with each other. And so Chris, actually came through our program. We, you know, helped him out with some stuff and he wanted to give back to our organization. And so, his passion is physical fitness. And so his gym in New York City, he came up with this idea, you know, partnering with us in his cause, the I Got Your Six, cause, and creating a workout, you know, platform, a competition series, if you will. And so people can join. And we did it, just completed it this last year, where people can sign up and partake in the physical fitness, you know, competition aspect. And we get sponsors from, you know, corporate sponsors and things like that, that help, you know, sponsor the event. We did two live events. One was in Georgia, one was in New York City. And then we did an online event where people could see the workout. They could do the workout at home. They could post their score. You know, we had winners for different classes. And so just trying to bring the physical fitness and the mental, or the, you know, physical health and mental health together, and promote both of those things. And we look forward to expanding that. So last year we did it for the first time in 2021, and we did one event in New York City. This year we did two events, one in Georgia and one in New York City. And we're looking forward to next year and partnering with some other folks and doing some more satellite events. I think we're going to do one in Colorado. You know, if we get some more folks that want to jump on board and host an event, they can, you know, different gyms and things like that, where we could open up those spaces. And on a day, you know, we have this communal, fitness event. So that's the I Got Your Six, Next Rung Throwdown, which is a great success.
That's awesome. And I think that anytime people can exercise, I've seen CrossFit, Spartan, places like that, a lot of people that have mental illness, they go to those places, and it's a great way to use your body to de-stress your brain. And I know that's how you think.
Absolutely.
I do want to wrap it up, because if I don't wrap it up, I know your wife. And she terrifies me. And so I want to make sure that we...
come on. She does not.
I want to make sure that we wrap up and say you don't get your butt in the sling because you didn't make your son's graduation. But talking about mental stress. How can people... What I loved about your program when you first told me about this was all the money goes to help kids. You're not here to profit. You're not here to make money. You make money from your job. You're here to help others. And I think that's a rarity. In fact, we had Navy SEAL on, and when we talked to him about Next Run, he goes, how much money goes to the program? I go, I want to say everything. You know, these guys don't take a dime. He goes, that's rare. And so I want the world to hear about this program. So we're going to post your link to your website on the description, but for people that are driving that don't have that, can you tell people how to donate to your program, how to get involved? If they're a fireman, how can they get part of your program? Can you just tell people how to get involved with you? Because you're fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So the website's real simple. It's just nextrung.org. And it's like, you know, next rung, like climbing the ladder. So climbing up to the next rung, just keep climbing forward. And up there on the website, on the top drop down menu, just go to the Change Lives campaign, because every dollar donated helps to change a life. And again, yes, like you said, 100% of that money that we raise goes right back into it. All of our peer support team is all volunteer. Blake, myself, our board of directors, no one is compensated any shape or form. Everyone, we all have the mindset of just leaving the fire service, the first responder community, better than we found it. Like, just leave it better than you found it. And it doesn't matter. It's not our money to do, you know, like what we want to do with it. You know, we're a faith-based organization, but we don't push that on anybody, but that's where we lead from. And that's, you know, it's not our money to deal with. So whatever, you know, God wants us to do with it, then he'll have us do with it. So, 100% of it goes right back into helping folks. We're on all the social medias, Next Rung, on Instagram, next_rung. Next Rung org on Facebook. You know, you can find us there, shoot us messages. And if you have any inquiries about, you know, being involved or doing whatever, you can just shoot us an email at info@nextrung.org is a good way to connect with us, just through a simple email.
Wow. You know what, Charlie, I'm going to end on that, because that is fantastic. You are a godly man. I love you to death. And because of the kind of work you do, you have a purpose, and you're saving lives, not only in your job, you're saving lives outside your job. And very proud of you, very proud of the man you've become. So thank you for thank you for being on our show, telling your story. And I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Kraken Backs Podcast. We hope you enjoyed, and make sure you follow our Instagram at Kraken Backs Podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday. See you next time.